Welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm Russ Hugo, and my guest tonight is Jim Beard. How's it going tonight, Jim?
Hey, great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, or glad to be back, I guess I should say.
Okay, so tonight we're going to be talking about Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. This is episode number 4 of season 3. It was directed by David Nutter and, of course, written by Darren Morgan. The original air date was October 13th of 1995. Before we get into some of the other fun facts about the episode, tell me generally what your first impression of the episode is.
I love it. Without any caveats to that, I think this is a really great time in the show. You know, the actors have settled into their roles and they're kind of experimenting, bringing a little bit sort of some humor in with the darkness. You know, I find it really interesting that this is only the second episode written by Darren Morgan, but he hit it right on and gotten such acclaim for this episode, and it won Emmy Awards and everything. So not bad second time out of the gate.
What would you give it out of 10?
Oh, boy. I mean, it, definitely a 9. And I know I said just a little bit ago I didn't really have any caveats, but you know, very little for me gets a 10, but absolutely a 9.
Well, before we'll get into all the details, my impressions kind of match similar to yours. It's resting right between a 9 and a 9.5. There are a few things we'll get into that I think it could have done. I mean, this is nitpicking. It's a beautiful piece of writing. Taking it up into a 10 that are actually found in some of Morgan's other writing, specifically Jose Chung's From Outer Space. But that's almost cruel to, but, you know, we got to find something to talk about, something to criticize.
Right. Okay, we agree. Next episode.
Okay, we're done. You did mention, though, that this was a real landmark watershed moment for The X-Files with 2 Emmy wins. So one Emmy for Outstanding Writing in a Drama Series. And then another for Outstanding Guest Actor for the lead there, Peter Boyle, playing Clyde Bruckman.
Well-deserved.
IMDb scores at 9.3, which is the highest for the season. And just to give it reference, the lowest, can you guess what the lowest rated episode was for season 3?
Oh, I'm not so sure I want to guess. I'll probably be wrong on that one. What was it?
Pressure. Tesos dos Bichos.
Oh, okay.
For 6.0. Which is, you know, pretty generous considering.
Yeah. Do you agree with that?
As being the lowest of the season?
Yeah.
I do. I mean, I don't agree with a 6, but I think it's probably the weakest.
Yeah.
It's got some, in some sense, I don't hate it because I think it's fun that they attempted something like that, but because of, and this will be saved for that episode when people talk about it, but there's some political and ethical problems with the episode in addition to the plotting and everything else. But the fact that they attempted to film an episode with a bunch of crazy cats, I gotta, you know, hey, hooray, we got 9 seasons. I'm glad we had that episode.
I'm glad that we all agree with on Clyde Bruckman, though. What'd you say,
9.3? 9.3, yeah.
There you go. Wow. I'm gonna agree completely with that. 9.3. That sounds great.
Dan, let's head in and talk about the episode in a little bit more detail. Before we get into the actual breakdown of the episode, I wanted to go through some of the fun actors and some of the cameos and people we've seen in some other X-Files episodes. Did you recognize anybody that stood out to you as a fun performance that you might have, or a fun performer you may have recognized? So what did you think about Stu Charno's performance as the killer?
I hadn't watched this in a little while, and I rewatched it, you know, before we talked about that. But did he end up in another X-Files episode?
I don't know that he did. I believe, though, he is related to a writer on the X-Files. What did you think about his performance?
It's fairly one note. And boy, when I started to say that, I thought that sounded kind of cruel to the guy. It's perfectly serviceable. It's not on the par of, Boyle's. What Boyle is doing is so kind of low key, but it's almost genius in a way. What our killer is doing is, boy, this is a tough one because it's a very subtle performance. I really like the part where he finally gets with Clyde, and he's kind of, you know, it's like just two guys sitting around shooting the breeze. You know, it's almost like he's kind of relieved, and they're it's almost kind of a chummy little thing. And I think that's kind of at the moment where he's at his best in this episode.
I was actually surprised when I rewatched the episode that I found his performance to be actually one of the highlights. I can understand where you come by for being one note, but the fact that he's playing a puppet, as he's sort of credited, and someone without free will and is coasting through and is taking everything so nonchalantly. Boyle was definitely more restrained, but in the sense of a characterization. And that's, I mean, he deserved his Emmy. While this was more of almost just a reflection of this complete sort of acquiescing to the nature, the momentum of the universe. But he's much more casual as opposed to the Boyle's almost tired, weary lethargy that he's portraying. Cynicism. This guy's kind of almost upbeat and chipper. In some sense, like, oh, that's what it is, but not in a way that's really engaged. And I think it works well contrasting with Boyle. But
yeah, I really agree with you. I think he could have gone over a line and made it more farcical or kind of a, you know, he looks like a real kind of a geek or nerd, you know, physically. And his voice doesn't have a fairly deep timbre or anything like that to it. But, you know, I think he could have probably, but, you know, he had admirable restraint in that. Again, I really love the scene where Bruckman tells him what his problem is. You know, he's wondering this whole time. And when he tells him that, you know, and that kind of, you know, light that comes into his eyes and that, you know, that so that's what it is, kind of a thing. So, yeah, and I in no way, I don't dislike his performance. You know, I like it. I just think it's kind of overshadowed by Peter Boyle.
And that's a fine thing to be overshadowed by.
Yeah, for real.
As a fun little bit of trivia here, according to Wikipedia, Stu is married to Sarah Charno, who wrote the second season episode, Aubrey.
There's some nepotism going on there, huh?
Yeah, but it's delayed. It's been a season. That's fine.
Okay. We'll let that one go, right?
Yes, yeah. So also the tarot dealer is played by Alex Diakun, who apart from quite a few roles in The X-Files, in Humbug, I think was one of his first performances, and then basically Darren Morgan kept using him, and he's always effective, a nice character actor. Darren, I don't know if he's mentioned in interviews or not, but it seems to have his stable of British Columbian character actors that have shown up, and you know they've done good work, and it's good to see them. So I kind that, of it's you a know, fun thing about the X-Files.
That's interesting that a writer would have the ability or the power to impact who is cast as actors like that. I mean, generally that's, you know, the casting director and the director's choice, you know, maybe even the producer or whatever. That's very interesting. I wonder, you know, how much Darren Morgan actually, you know, leaned on people, if he was convinced that one actor was better than another for a role that he'd written. It's interesting.
Maybe it helps that he was outside of the normal mythology, and also being in comedy episodes, that the tone of the actors, that he in his mind knows what he's wanting to present and the delivery of the material, so
yeah,
he'll have a better idea than other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another is, this is a tough one to pronounce, but I'm going to give it a shot, of Jaap Roker, who played the stupendous Yappy.
Yeah, I think it's funny that, you know, he's the stupendous Yappy, and his first name is really Yap, spelled with a J, of course, rather than a Y. But yeah, I think you're probably saying that right, Jaap Roker.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's an A or an A. It has the two A's in the Roman alphabet. It's a guess. We're going to live on the edge, but he's famous for being Duchovny's stand-in.
Oh, really?
A fun casting choice there. That they let's give him a role. What do you think about his performance?
You know, it's good. He's not really in it very much. He has a very interesting accent, which I think it makes people remember him. But again, it's perfectly serviceable for what's demanded in that role.
He plays up the camp, and it's nice to have a little bit of that in there to balance some of the more subdued performances. And I think it's nice. It actually is a good counterpoint to Boyle's more relaxed performance. Other person I wanted to comment on is, I didn't even make the connection until this time watching it, is Ken Roberts, who played the clerk at the very beginning in the convenience store. And he's been in X-Files Colony, but I recognize him primarily as the father of the accused killer in the Millennium episode, Sacrament. His performance in that episode in particular is really impressive. It's nonverbal, but it's disturbing. And so it's fun to kind of see him play a casual, cheerful person for once. So now to get into the episode. So at the very beginning, we hear someone, a voiceover, who is Clyde Bruckman, reading some predictions. And one of them that's not read, but you can see briefly on the screen because it shows the cover, I will read for you now, is that police disclosure that a coffee house chain uses narcotics in their brewing process. Sales at the cafes will plummet, but only for a day or two.
Okay. That's pretty good. I really love this scene because I think Boyle is so good in it. And again, it's subtle, but I think it kind of lays the hint that you're in for something a little bit more special with this episode and with Peter Boyle being in it. I love the way he reads from the tabloid. And again, it's all pretty subtle, but I think it's... you know, it's like good things are about to happen in this episode.
And it's another nice example of Dara Morgan's wonderful scene transitions, in particular episode transitions, where there's this a nice gateway into the world of the episode. Not so much in Humbug, but it's still this nice fake out in Humbug. But especially in Jose Chung's From Outer Space and Doomsday Defense have similar fun. And then, of course, Forehead Sweat recently did that too. The next thing he goes and sees the psychic, who's played by Karen Carnival, who's of course famous for playing the mother in Home and the two people in Plus One. And he's talking about, you know, why he does the things he does. I gotta say, the coat the killer is wearing, I wanted to say, is fantastic. I love that. And I particularly like this performance by Stu Charno when he's talking to him. I think it's a little bit more intense than the others, a little bit more unhinged, but not too much. And I enjoy that quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I was trying to say before. It's, you know, he could have made this farcical or you know, a little over the top, but he dials it back, you know, enough to keep it still believable and interesting.
He then murders her, and then we cut to Act One. We're in Minneapolis. And we are in a crime scene where a bunch of cops are describing somebody whose work is spooky, and they're kind of priming us to see somebody come through the door, and they're priming us that it's going to be Mulder. But we are surprised when Mulder and Scully come through and the cops ask, "Who are you?"
Right. I love that part.
This sort of subversion happens frequently in Morgan scripts, but especially in this one, there's a lot of those bits. We'll get into them later with Boyle and Clyde Bruckman. So instead, who they're waiting for is, of course, the stupendous Yappy, who puts on this nice performance of a sorts, and we're able to enjoy him challenging Mulder and questioning Mulder's skepticism. There's a lot of fake-outs in this episode. A lot of humor comes from subverting our expectations. Any thoughts about this scene?
I like Dara Morgan supposedly wanted to turn the character of Mulder on his ear, I guess is a way of saying it. And actually supposedly said that he wanted to make him a bit ridiculous. This is kind of funny because, you know, you would expect Mulder to be in his element, and he is actually coming off, you know, pretty badly in this scene. Well, here's something I want to ask you about the stupendous Yappy. Are we to believe that he has any psychic power whatsoever?
Well, that's actually a good question. Let's stop and go, maybe, because most of the things he states could be about anyone, but there are some things later that Bruckman backs up that probably they would not have guessed being the same otherwise. So I think, like nearly every Morgan script of this type, it's meant to be ambiguous. But
okay.
More likely than not to be phony. So maybe phony who just happened to get one small thing right, or a few things right. What do you think?
I think that the question is out there. I think at first you think he's a complete charlatan, but there's something about it where, like you're saying, you know, that it's ambiguous. That question is there. You can't really come down on a complete yes or no with him. You know, I think it would be interesting if he did actually have a little bit, you know, why did he take up this job, you know, this job, as it were. And but yeah, you know, that's the question with so many of these people. We used to do this. So when, if you remember, there was a psychic or medium named John Edward several years back that was pretty popular. He had his own TV show.
Was he the cold reader for like afterlife?
Yeah, he used to say like, who's the man that begins with the letter M? He's coming through right now. Mm. You know, he used to, but you know, my wife and I used to sit there, and you wanted to believe it at first, but then the more you thought about it, it's like, well, he is asking kind of some leading questions. I mean, it's the same thing with Yappy. I love, you know, the whole explanation that Mulder gives about, you know, how he's coming up with the things that he's coming up. But I still am left with, it's not completely clear whether Yappy has some psychic powers or not.
I mean, you could say there's the idea of the two people, the description of the killer and the woman on the floor. That could be an illusion, because Bruckman backs that up. And then whether that's true or not, or if they both just guessed it, but
well,
they both got the same location. And then also him noticing Mulder's skepticism. While for the fans where you think it's going to be on Scully, in this instance,
yeah,
Mulder, his skepticism is much more primal at this point. It's a lot more, yeah, more anger backing that.
Now, anybody could, pretty much anybody could perhaps sense that there's, you know, one person among however many in a room that doesn't agree with you. Yeah, I mean, you, again, it's that ambiguous thing. It could be that he really is sensing some negative energy coming off of Mulder, which is ironic, of course. But you know, you brought up something about the two people on the floor, that both Yappy and Bruckman were drawn to that spot. Okay, well, I still think it's odd that the killer doesn't strike me as somebody who's just going to have spontaneous sex with somebody like that, I guess. To me, it just came off as an odd thing. Not necessarily a bad thing, but just maybe it was just something that I wasn't getting from everything else that was going on there. But okay, that makes more sense now.
My hunch is you may have written it in there in a sense to subvert expectations about killers and this like, and the idea that she initiated.
And indeed.
He's so passive in all of his, yeah, other actions, or at least,
yes,
he sees himself being passive, and so when somebody else is being assertive, he's just going to comply, and then that's,
gotcha, okay. Well, again, it's ambiguous. You know, I think I'm probably, again, and I don't mean to jump ahead so far, but I'm thinking about this a lot, and especially after I watched this episode, as to, is Clyde Bruckman infallible, or is his visions or whatever he's doing, is it fallible? So this is what's interesting, is when he really starts coming through with the, you know, what he's seeing or what he's feeling or what he's knowing. And it leads, to me, it leads into a lot of questions about everything that is revealed as this episode goes on.
That's, yeah, one of the fun reasons to rewatch it is, where does that line go? We know that he has hypothetically no control over changing anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, but yet he does display some agency at the end. He's able to be incredibly accurate, but not aware of how accurate he is when they stop and they later look for the body in the car, and they end up stopping the car right on where the body is, but they don't know it. But there's sometimes where it seems like it's implied. Well, also, the scene with Mulder, which we'll get to, that he sees Mulder being killed, but Mulder isn't killed. So we have to ask, is it a matter of we're able to change the fate because we know what happened, or just because there's still just play and he's not accurate? It's tricky to know. I wonder if it's more of the idea that Darren's trying to make about perhaps Bruckman feels so defeated by his lack of control in life. He's unable to recognize in what way he is able to have control in his life, and instead it becomes apathetic.
Yeah.
The idea that he thinks he has none, but he actually does have some, and that's part of the fatalism, is part of the pathos.
I like how, as the episode progresses, that we are learning the definition of his gifts, his powers, almost as he is and Mulder and Scully are. That you finally get to the point where I think it's Scully who clarifies everything by basically saying, okay, so what you're doing is seeing how people die. You know, finally, after a little while, it's stated fairly straightforward and plainly, what you're doing is you see how people die. And I'm not so sure he realized that that's exactly what he was doing either.
I'll watch it in, because I had always picked up that he knew that that was what he could do, and that's why he thought it was a curse and not a gift. Because when he asks Mulder and he says, do you want to know how you die and when you die? And he goes, sure. No, you don't. It seemed like something that he had thought about for a long time. But I may totally have missed the boat on that one. But or it could be ambiguous. Who knows? So after Yappy leaves, Bruckman is then meeting a young couple, trying to sell them some insurance. And he kind of goes into a trance and tells him about how he's going to die. And the man responds, you gotta work on your closing line, or something to that degree.
And right.
Says that this is a really important thing. You have a wife and kids. And he says, well, I'd rather buy a boat. It's a very nice boat. Any thoughts about this scene?
It seems to be there more to be a punchline than anything. It's another way of showing us that he doesn't really have control over the gift, that it's interfering with his livelihood in a way. But again, it just sort of ends up more of a punchline, you know, a humorous moment than anything. I don't hate it at all. You know, it's just, do we need that scene? It's hard to say.
I always found the scene to be very important in the sense that it gives Bruckman a redeeming quality. The implication is that he is sort of using his powers for good by going around to people who he knows will die, selling them insurance so that their family can be protected.
Oh, that's a good way.
They don't listen to him, and he's, you know, they're overwhelmed and they don't take his wisdom. It becomes even more defeating and depressing because now he knows he tried, he failed to help them. But it's also his living, so there's this mundane aspect that he still wants to do it. But in the background, it is basically he has this gift and doing something with it. And that's, it rounds the character. I enjoyed it. I don't like, no offense to them, I don't like the young father's performance. I think it's a little too cartoonish, particularly coming from Bruckman's trancy monologue that is really grim. And the situation that's just described, I'm not sure how else it could have been performed, but I find it kind of takes you out of the real depressing seriousness of what's going to happen, in the sense that mother and child are going to be left broke without a partner, surprisingly, and they're going to realize that they didn't listen when somebody told them. It's a very tragic situation to have a punchline, but, you know, that's Darren Morgan for you.
Yeah, not every actor can be Peter Boyle, too.
No. We still got it. There's a lot of great character actors in this episode. And not saying that person is a bad actor. This is one of those things about being picky about the 10 out of 10 versus a 9, is there's a few beats like this where the pathos of the story, they get truncated or they get bumped in ways that it messes with the rhythm and the weight, I think the emotional weight of the episode.
Yeah.
Okay, so then Bruckman, he goes home, he talks to his neighbor with the dog, and who, of course, becomes the immortal, not immortal, but immortal in many fans' hearts, Queequeg, and goes down to the dumpster and finds the body. And also, around the same time, before he goes to the dumpster, backing up, he opens the fridge, pulls out a head of lettuce or cabbage in a plastic bag, and sees what looks like a head. I, until maybe my third time watching it, could barely tell what that was. I just knew it was something gross. I thought it was just rotting lettuce and didn't make the connection that, oh, that's him. He's seen his death there. What are your thoughts about any of those things?
Oh, okay. Now, that's interesting because I immediately recognized it as a head, but I guess I never really recognized it as his head.
Yeah, it wasn't until I paid attention and realized at the end, oh, he has a bag around his head.
Oh.
And so
okay.
Definitely.
Wow. Jeez, my face red. Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Huh. Very, very good. Wow. That's, I love that. That's really interesting. That really ramps up that scene even more than that. It's not just, you know, a shock type moment, but that it's actually a great foreshadowing, you know, of the end. Huh.
Again, I could be wrong. It may not supposed to be his head, but who knows?
Well, I think it's absolutely, you know, geez, it seems very logical, you know, especially when you call out about that his head is wrapped, that he puts the bag over his head at the end there.
Spoilers.
Yeah, right.
So he goes down to throw that out in the dumpster and then finds a body of Madame Zelma, the first psychic mm-hmm. that we see in the cold open. And then Mulder and Scully show up, talk to him, and try to get him to... Mulder kind of believes he has a talent and tries to rope him into coming to visit the Tessiographer's apartment. And I guess they ask him a question. He says he made a report to the police, I believe, that the eyes were cut out, but the body was face down, so that was the first clue that he had some psychic ability.
Right.
At this point,
of course he's the killer.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Of course, it puts him into being potentially a suspect.
Yeah.
Good point. Or while he's walking around the apartment, a couple things are brought up. One is just talking about life and control of life and agency, free will. This is a major topic of the entire episode, and with the woman victims and her hobby as a doll collector is asked, so what does it take for any of us to be at one position, but also to what is it that makes us develop our hobbies and our interests and things like that?
You know, there's a lot of dialogue that, you know, that comes from Bruckman that could have been really kind of heavy-handed. You know, when you get into some of these more philosophical subjects in this, you know, the whole talk of free will, but there's something about Peter Boyle's delivery that it never becomes, you know, so deep or whatever. It's that simple, you know, down to earth, almost New Yorkian, you know, philosophy thing that he does that makes you want to keep on watching, that you just sort of don't tune out, you know, when he's delivering a monologue or anything about this. And I think that's just really part of the beauty of his performance here and why he absolutely was deserving of that. And
I would totally agree, not only with his ability to do that, but also his ability to transition between serious monologues to comedy and then actual drama and kind of switch between them so effortlessly.
It's really
fun. But yeah, great point. He then predicts, after a while, he predicts about the victim. The body will be found in Glenview Lake near a fat little white Nazi stormtrooper.
Yeah, that's great.
So then the next scene we're cut to is at that lake where a body is found. And again, this is the issue. Scully is, maybe he knew the killer, maybe he is the killer, or that he's lucky. And then Mulder, of course, they go about the propane tank and say, but, you know, doesn't it look like this? You know, Scully first responds, of course, but, you know, you'll start looking for symbols and patterns where they are, and then
yeah,
responds with the same question again, but you didn't answer it. doesn't it look like that? That's another fun quirk of the episode, is the vagueness about psychic powers. And if you actually did have them, how would you be able to tell? I mean, proving them in some ways would be fruitless or pointless. Anything you want to add to this scene? Anything stand out to you?
Only that I think in this episode we get probably some of Scully's best dry sarcasm to this point in the show. You know, she just does that so well. That dripping sarcasm thing. And, you know, and Mulder's pretty sarcastic in this too, but they actually have these sort of different takes on sarcasm. I love sarcasm, you know, in fiction and in real life too. Some people might call it wit, but you know, I love a sarcastic character, and it's so great to have two characters who are both sarcastic but yet sort of different takes on being sarcastic in this. But yeah, she's so dryly sarcastic throughout this till the end.
Anderson's performance throughout on this episode is fantastic.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think that by this point they're very comfortable, you know, in their roles and really inhabiting them, I guess is the best way to say it.
Okay, next, Mulder goes to visit Bruckman again, and Bruckman is sitting in his apartment with a seemingly annoyed or seemingly bothered as Mulder knocks. And then Bruckman's talking to him as if it's Mulder. I think he says something to the degree, he says something like, "You and your lady partner, blah, 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 blah." Mulder walks in and he's like, "Oh, it's you." Surprised. It's going back to that previous joke that's been done a few times, similarly with Stupendous Yappy and Mulder at the beginning. This is one scene, that one transition, I don't think works. I could be wrong, and I'd like you to correct me. I can't think of anyone else who Bruckman would be describing other than Mulder, because we have not met anyone else who would be coming to his apartment that has a female partner or anything that would be motivated to do that. It had to be Mulder. So who else would he be thinking of? And at that point, I'm not sure the joke really works. But I could be a curmudgeon.
You know, you're highlighting this right now, and that didn't really occur to me while last time I watched it. But yes, you know, I'm gonna agree that is a little weak then. Yeah, because you're right. There really isn't anybody else that kind of matches that. It's not like the police were a male-female duo or anything like that.
And this is sort of where we first start seeing the trend in the episode of Mulder badgering Bruckman about his psychic abilities, and Bruckman getting very annoyed and not wanting to help with the whole investigation, but eventually kind of acquiesces. We transition to the scene where he's testing a bunch of objects for Mulder, and he's not having much luck, but there's that nice, wonderful scene where he holds up the piece of fabric when Mulder and Scully are talking, and Bruckman says to them, "Is this from your New York Knicks shirt?" And he says, "Oh, that's a miss." It's a fun throwback to Beyond the Sea.
Yeah.
And I always wondered if that was Mulder lying, because it just seems, where else? What else would that be? But, okay.
You know what I forgot? There's a really great thing between Bruckman and Mulder, and this was early on when he makes them show them their badges to him again. And when he looks at Mulder's and he says, "Is that a real name?" I love that. I should have thought of that before while we were at that point, but it's just occurring to me now.
I'll bring them up when they come up. It's one of those episodes.
Yeah. What's the episode? There's more than one episode with something about Mulder's name. What's the episode where they're riding in a car, and the one guy says to Mulder, he says, "Mulder, is that some kind of Jew name?"
Oh, I think you're thinking that's Drive.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You know, and it's just how many times for some reason his name is being made light of, you know.
So I think talk about Claude Dukenfield, who is an owner of the company they're checking out, and then Bruckman believes that he's dead, and they go to look for the body, and they're driving in the car, and this is a very famous scene where he describes Mulder's death, and they stop, and they're talking about the Big Bopper, and Buddy
Okay,
Holly.
Now hold on a second.
Yeah.
Is the whole thing, in your opinion, is the whole thing about Mulder's death BS?
Yes, I believe. No, I could be wrong. I think it was Darren Morgan when he was interviewed by Kumail Nanjiani on his podcast that the thing about Scully being immortal was just Bruckman being nice.
And yeah.
It's not actually true. And similarly, I then interpret that this is just Bruckman being annoyed at Mulder. Mulder's constant badgering about the psychic abilities. What do you think?
Mulder's childlike constant badgering too. You know, he can get kind of giddy at sometimes in this. He's such a fanboy, I guess, as you want to say. I love the scene. I love the way Mulder is sitting on the edge of his seat in the back and hanging, you know, sticking his head up, you know, because it reminded me of being a kid when back in the day when we didn't use seat belts and we kids were in the back seat of the car, but I would sit in between my older brother and sister, but on the edge of my seat and hang on the back of the front seat. And stick my head, you know, in there to talk to my mother and father. So that really reminded me. There's something really honest and innocent about Mulder doing that in this episode. But not to say that Bruckman is unintelligent, but I guess I'm a little surprised that if he's BSing that whole thing and or he's making it up or whatever, that he would know the term autoerotic asphyxiation. Right?
My thought is, though, that his psychic power doesn't grant him lexical knowledge, so I think he would have to know the term to describe it, whether he knew it or not. But it's possible. My thought is, you know, this is somebody who reads, like, the National Enquirer, and I'm sure that's a headline every issue, but I'm not sure.
True. I'll grant you that. It might also be our writer really wanting this scene, this punchline or whatever, and kind of saying, like, you know, I'm going to, whatever. He knows this term somehow, you know. But it's a great scene because it's almost believable. You know, we know that Mulder has some interest in porn, you know. This is kind of funny because I actually included this in my own X-Files story that I wrote for the X-Files anthology that I made sure to have a little mention of Mulder's interest in porn at the beginning of the story.
And it also follows up with Darren Morgan's next script with Jose Chung's From Outer Space. The ending with Mulder watching the Bigfoot video. So Morgan definitely likes to take that character trait to an extreme. So
right.
Who knows? It could be real. Okay. So next they get out of the car and they're looking for the body. And this is where the discussion that ties in to a lot of the other threads about chance and free will.
Yeah.
With the Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper, and then, of course, Buddy Holly referring back to the opening scene where he's going to reunite with the crickets and go to Lollapalooza. What do you think about this overall thread, this philosophical thread through the episode, and how effective it is?
I think it's very, very effective. I really enjoyed the whole thing talking about Buddy Holly and Big Bopper. If you're not really aware of the whole real life story of that crash and everything, it may seem like a tangent that he's going off on a tangent first, but it's a really fascinating story. A very sad one, obviously, but and I think it's a really great way to, you know, keep reinforcing the theme of this episode. And I really dig it that Brookman was a big bopper fan. And I think he says it like more than once that I was a big bopper fan, which is funny because basically the big bopper had one hit, you know, Chantilly Lace. And I really enjoy that particular hit too, in that particular recording. But you know, it's kind of funny that Brookman would be a fan of the Big Bopper, you know, compared to Buddy Holly and his multiple hits.
Yeah, another example of the reversions that expectation reversals, which I guess is a form of nearly or the source of nearly almost all kinds of humor. But when Scully says, "I find that really hard to believe, Mr. Brookman," he goes, "No, it's true. Yeah, I was a bigger fan of the Big Bopper than Buddy Holly." That's one of the times where it really lands well.
Yeah. What a simple little line, but she delivers it so well. I find that really hard to believe, Mr. Brookman.
And then they eventually find the body under the car, and they go back, and Brookman receives a letter from the killer saying he's going to kill them. It was postmarked on the day before Brookman actually started helping them on the investigation.
Yeah.
So that there is some psychic action at work there with the killer too, and the cops then start to protect Brookman, and the scene transitions to the killer visiting the tarot dealer. This one played by Alex Dicoun, who seems to be the most effective psychic of all of them that he's visited, but he gets killed anyways.
Yeah. So yeah, in the middle of all this, we actually get someone who probably really did have some abilities. Should Mulder have said something to Brookman when Brookman starts describing the scene of seeing the killer coming up and cutting his throat? Should Mulder have said, "Wait a minute, that's, you said that I died by autoerotic asphyxiation"? Maybe that would have been a funny little thing to have thrown in there.
It probably would have been a nice time to do a quip. Yeah. But I guess that's the reason why I think that whole thing is just to get a rise out of Mulder. But yeah, that's a change that could be made to boost a little bit of point. A wasted opportunity for a Duchovny one-liner. I agree with you there. So then now Brookman's in a hotel room with protective custody and is with Scully initially.
She plays that scene very well.
Yes.
With that sort of subtle embarrassment, you know, when he says we're dead together, and she says something like, "That's not going to happen, you know, Mr. Brookman," or something like that. But she's very, very good in that scene. I really enjoy that scene.
Great delivery. That's another example of Anderson just nailing this entire episode.
Yeah.
She's in sync with Peter Boyle the entire time.
And she's, you know, becoming, she's warming up to him. You know, the slow transition of her warming to him is very nice, very nicely handled throughout this.
Yeah, and that's something I was going to put in my summary, is one of the things that makes this episode so incredible is that it's 42 minutes or something, and how much story, how many jokes, and how much characterization they were able to pack into here and make it feel satisfying is incredible.
Yeah, it is really, really a great use of the time. And I think that's, you know, another reason why I rate this episode so high. That it's all so well used and well paced, you know. Talk a lot about pacing in film, and to be able to get that characterization, like you say, and to also keep the story moving and suspenseful is really, really something. It's a credit to everybody involved in this.
Next major scene, just kind of moving ahead relatively quickly, is when Brookman and Mulder are talking. They're lying down, and Mulder is asking if Brookman has any prophecies, any dreams like this. And then he talks about the recurring dream of him lying dead and decomposing. Mm. And that scene, I've always liked the look of the scene stands out so much from the cold, shadowy look of the rest of the show. And I always thought, well, it is a wonderful time capsule for mid-90s or early 90s, like alternative music videos like Blind Melon or Soundgarden or something. It just has that MTV look to it. Yeah. What do you think about the whole scene in the monologue and the dream?
It's really effective. You know, in some ways, they perhaps didn't even truly need to show us. You know, I think maybe Boyle could have delivered that whole thing and painted the picture with just him speaking in words. But to actually see it is really something. It's a really interesting use of early computer graphics. From what I understand, it's both computer graphics and actual, you know, prop use or you know, whatever you want to say. But yeah, that's a really good point about the color use in that compared to the sort of the muted palette of the rest of the episode.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn in that I think it provides a very nice iconic visual for what is otherwise a fairly rote, you know, imagery-wise. There's mm-hmm. some nice things, but it provides something that can work as a thumbnail for episode descriptions and the rest. But I'm actually with you in your initial statement that I think it could have been a little bit more effective. It's not really a hindering, but I would have preferred to just zoom in on Boyle's face and have him be looking up at the ceiling reciting it. I think it could have been a little bit more terrifying. There, it's kind of disturbing, but it's also slightly comical, which it, because of the dialogue, it's also supposed to be. The tone of it is just a little bit different than the rest of the episode. It kind of upsets the rhythm by jumping off to this dream sequence at this point, but it's not a big deal. But you know, we're here to nitpick, so I'm nitpicking.
If you would have gotten other more, you know, portrayals of visions or things from him, would it have not seemed like that to you, I wonder?
We get a few visions, but they weren't like this. And this is also a dream, so I'll give him that. But it was also, it's considerably long, and the look of it is so different, and the feeling of it is
true.
So different. It doesn't make it bad, but it is, we're already now into the third act, and this I think might have fit better in the second act, but
okay,
totally nitpicky. This is I'm crazy, I admit it. I'm scraping up for material. I mean, this is one of the most talked about episodes of all time, so we got to find something to make it interesting. Let me just check real quick with the listeners, or see if they're still awake. Hey, next is Detective Chavez, I guess, comes in and is telling jokes and then asks if he's going to die from cancer. Bruckman says, just kind of nods his head calmly, knowingly what's going to happen. And he says, don't answer the door. And then immediately Bruckman goes up and answers the door. This is what's weird. Okay, you can maybe talk about the same thing. Go for it.
Well, wait a minute. I want to talk about Chavez.
Okay, go for it.
This is a moment where I think the actor is kind of weak, and it shows. And I think it's because we get him right after a few really good scenes where Boyle really excels, and we have Duchovny and Anderson, and they're doing a great job. And when I rewatched this, I thought that this guy kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, to be quite honest. Maybe it's just because he's coming in on the heels of that, but I don't care much for his performance here.
That's interesting. I felt that he was mildly annoying, and then looking at the script, I kind of felt that was what he was supposed to be.
Okay.
It's sort of cloying, because it's this transitionary period where he is the authority figure over Bruckman. Bruckman's going to escape. He's going to die. And Bruckman's partially held responsible. And Bruckman at this point is just coming resigned. This is the moment right before here, because his discussion with Scully and his discussion with Mulder, where he finally realizes, oh, I'm going to die soon. And at this point, he's talking to the guy, and he's just kind of like, he has a little bit of pity, and it comes across, but the guy feels more pathetic because he's sort of annoying. So, yeah. I mean, no arguments in the sense of, your subjective feeling coming on his performances there. I felt it worked a little better for me, but
okay.
I hear you.
I do feel for him as far as, he gets killed by a serial killer, So there is a little bit of, depth of feeling there. And like I said, I'm admitting it could be just because he comes in after some really good, or some really fine, acting. That could be what it is as far as my reaction to this guy.
Bruckman now lets the killer in. This is one part that confuses me. But you can kind of explain it, and I'll talk it through for why it confuses me first, which is he goes to answer the door when he was told not to, implying that he sort of has a death wish, but then is surprised that the person he lets in is the killer. So
right.
Maybe he just had a suspicion that it would be the killer, or he's going to let anybody in, it's the killer, because he knows he's going to die soon. But then once the killer comes in, he realizes, oh, he's not going to kill him now. So this makes me think maybe Bruckman doesn't have a clear vision of exactly how and when he's going to die. But that sort of contradicts the vision with the bag and how much he knows about how Mulder's going to die.
Yeah. So
this part is where the episode breaks down for me. It's not super clear or consistent with the rules that have been set out before. It doesn't ruin the episode or anything, but it would have been... There's a few moments where my brain has to stop and go, wait a minute, why... Is this happening in this exact way? It can all be explained, but it's not the most comfortable with considering with the rest of the narrative flow.
Is it because it's him and his own death?
It totally could be, but we don't know that. I mean, it's easy. Yeah. That's a great explanation, and I think even that makes it even better. But even without an explanation, there is a way you can make it work within the narrative structure, but it takes a lot of work. And I think, unfortunately for me, is it takes away some of the pathos of we leave Bruckman at this point after he talks with the killer, and we do not see him again until the very end where he's already committed suicide.
Yeah.
I would have liked something more to kind of transition us from there between those two things. But we don't actually get any cues. We get some hints, but it's all stuff that he's talked about before. He's talked about death and knowing that people are going to die. So the Scully and Mulder interaction really, to me, unless he's completely isolated from other people, which he may be, it seems like he's lonely, but he interacts with people through his work. So what really is the trigger? What prompted this thing other than... Now the killer is there, and now he knows that he's identified the killer, so that was the only thing he could see himself doing in the future. I'm not sure if I'm making sense, but it's that part of the arc for him that I would have liked a little bit more color.
Okay. I think I see what you're saying, and I'm not completely disagreeing with it, but it didn't necessarily occur to me like that while I was watching. Sometimes it's funny. I'll watch something that somebody else has watched, and they will come away from it and say, saying plot holes. And I don't know what it is. Sometimes I just watch something and I go along, things go along, and whether or not there are plot holes, it's to me, the baseline is, am I enjoying this as I'm watching it? And then maybe later, maybe start picking it apart a little bit. But I wasn't thinking that at this time. I think I was just being kind of carried along, by the whole thing. And that's not to downplay at all, what you're saying. Scripts, fiction have to have an internal consistency, obviously. But do you feel like, it didn't fully pull you out of the whole thing, right?
No, I want to clarify. Yeah, I wouldn't define this as a plot hole. It's not a flaw in the sense of the script. I would use instead a room for improvement. Because one of my issues with this episode, which I love, and I'm giving a 9 and a 9.5, is that the emotional resonance of Bruckman's death, just with a little bit more tweaking, I think, and I'm not the genius who could necessarily do it, but I think it needed to happen here, could have been a lot more impactful. Because we get from Scully's talk with him, Mulder has a similar talk that we've already had, basically. We've already had that multiple times. And then we're jumping straight to he's dead. I would have something else. And not only is he dead, he killed himself. So what is the emotional, what was that beat that's going to push him over the edge? We know he's weary, it's this, but that's where he's been this entire episode. Yeah. That's the thing, is I haven't really seen, that's what he's been his entire life, it sounds like, once he developed this power.
So yeah.
That's all, I would just would like that more, so that when we get that scene with him and Scully, it just takes it a little bit further, and it's a beautiful scene. I'm not going to knock any of it. This is a thought I had. That's all.
If I understand what you're saying is it's you're not 100% invested in his suicide or the reasons behind it.
It's too sudden character wise.
Okay.
In the sense of. It's not necessarily too sudden. This is a very minor point. It works. Yeah. But I think that it could have been there's a lot that more could have been dug there about how he feels about suicide or even some sort of resignation. The fact that he lets the killer in and then says that then the confrontation is you don't kill me now. And then we just find out he ended up killing himself, but nothing else happened. So we can, as a viewer, it works really well because we can put it together in our hands.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But I would have liked to get a little bit more from him.
Two things. Could the death of his neighbor have been, something that pushed him enough over the edge? I might be clutching at straws with that one.
I mean, I don't think necessarily we have to have what pushed him over the edge, but I think it could. And even though he seemed to know his neighbor was going to die already two years ago, so that's not so much of a surprise. And he's just constantly surrounded by death. And that was hard for me to make this leap of a person who's, from the minute we meet him, morose, depressed, everything else. And the character arc we see is just essentially, he describes himself and we meet him through Mulder and Scully, and then he ends up killing himself.
Yeah.
But what really, and I'd like you to correct me, what really do we see special in his arc other than he opens himself up to Scully a little bit? That's it? And that's what leads him to kill himself? Or that's what leads him to free will? Or the fact that the killer, he ends up helping a killer, or he ends up helping an investigation and not actually being able to help it, and so the fact that he is being forced to deal with this futility and actually feel kind of culpable in the death of these people, or the fact that he's able to tell the killer, have the meeting. This is the reason the episode kind of gives us, is that he sits down with the killer face to face and says, "You're a killer because you're a homicidal maniac." And the killer's and that doesn't do anything and it doesn't stop anything.
Yeah.
And he's going to go kill himself. Is that gives him the moment to break free will or get some free will and kill himself, and that's going to subvert things. But it isn't free will because that's how he hypothetically knew he was going to die.
Why does he say to the killer, "You don't kill me now"? Is that complete BS?
I thought he says, "No, you don't do it now."
You don't do it now, which implies that he is killed by the killer at some point.
Or maybe he says it doesn't happen now. I can't remember. But yeah,
because in some ways, then the suicide is him taking control of his, well, I almost said life, but his death, his own death. Real quick, the scene with Mulder in the kitchen with the killer.
Yes.
It does not go the way Brookman explains it or tells Mulder about it, right?
Yes.
Okay, does that mean that Brookman is fallible in his what he sees?
That is the vagueness of the episode that on one hand makes the episode brilliant because it leaves room for interpretation, but on the other hand goes back to the point I'm making, which is maybe it could make it a little bit more clear in the sense of he tells the killer he doesn't kill him now. Maybe that is not true, and maybe he was supposed to kill him there, and then he's able to go home and kill himself, and it's subverts the free will. Maybe it's that decision, the fact that he decided to kill himself, that subverts the entire timeline, and that allows Mulder and Scully to, you know, play out events a little bit differently and survive.
Yeah.
It's all in my head. It's completely up in the air. It's not clear, but maybe our listeners will be able to say something on social media and correct me or I don't know.
Brugman does not know if Mulder survives. Am I correct? He's already gone by then.
Exactly.
Okay. It's, in a way, it's almost a shame that he doesn't, because then again, that could he could have said to himself, okay, well, I'm not perfect in what I see. See, I'm going back to, I almost would like to think that his suicide is his way of saying, I have control.
I would totally agree with you know, on that, and I wish there was more in the script.
Gotcha.
Hint at it.
Good. And we're right back to that, and I'm going to agree with you on that. It would almost need another scene or more in the note to Scully, you know, at the end.
Yes, that'd be a great place to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What does he say about the dog? Help me refresh my memory. What does he say about the dog to Scully?
Basically, you have to forgive the dog for what he did. He couldn't help it.
Okay. What did the dog do?
Ate the owner after the owner died.
Okay, that's what I thought. I don't know why, but my memory from when I originally watched this episode told me that there was more to that. And then I was a little surprised when I rewatched it, because I thought that was pointed. I thought it was a little bit more obvious exactly what the dog did. I had this memory that the dog ate the woman's eyes, which would go back to the thing earlier about the person having their eyes taken out or whatever. But that's not right. I mean, I didn't watch an edited version of this, I don't think.
It does show the dog in a flash forward eating her.
Okay, it
but
does.
It's very quick. Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right.
The door says, "Are you sure you have everything you need? You need dog food. Do you have enough dog food?"
That's right. You're right. Yeah. Boy, that is. Yeah. That's quick. Yep. Yep.
Oh, there's one thing I wanted to talk about back in the hotel is when Scully and Bruckman are first in there and he's eating the cake and he says, "Oh, this cream, this is the real stuff, not the fake stuff. I know the difference. And the chocolate, real rich." That acting there by Boyle is one of the best in the episode. Just nails it. I mean, that dialogue could be so boring or just, oh, but it's one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's just frosting, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
to use a cake analogy. I mean, it's just frosting, but yeah, you're right. You know, he gives every bit of this script, he gives it his all, which is funny because it's not a scenery chewing or anything like that at all. It's, you know, 100% pure Peter Boyle and what he does. And I'll say it again, he totally deserved the Emmy.
And that's where I kind of feel bad about nitpicking about the motivation for the death and all that, because ambiguity's nice, but there are so few places that I would want to cut. There are a few if we really had to go back through, but really, like you're saying, there's a lot of great frosting that makes it a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
So. There's so many, memorable things that you know. I mean, to this day, after my wife and I first watched the episode originally, you know, we still bring up his predictions. You know, we still talk about his predictions for both Mulder and Scully. You know, we bring up things from this, and we can't say that about every episode, you know, of X-Files. You know, this one has really stayed with me all these years, and Jose Chung's the same way too. It's just a beautiful little piece of writing and acting and production and everything. One of those perfect storm of an episode. It's one where, you know, people said, okay, you're going to sit somebody down who's never watched X-Files before. What do you show them? This is probably going to be pretty high on my list.
As long as they're roughly familiar with the characters, because a lot of the humor is based on the characters, then yes.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, and maybe a short explanation, you know, as to who Mulder and Scully are, you know, is necessary. But I think that the writing and the performances and the story could get them through, even if they're not totally familiar with the setup, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a classic. Before we just wrap up, a few final notes there about the chase at the end, as I really like the setup, the composition, the way it's directed, and a lot of the color tones, especially just at the beginning of the hallway where they're running through with the red and the black and the grays. I think it feels really nice, works well with the bellhop uniform. I definitely, yeah. One of, again, not to praise Anderson too much, but the scene where Mulder is almost about to be killed and Scully's coming down in the elevator, and just her transition from kind of just nonchalant, paying attention but not super alert, to noticing, holy cow, there's Mulder and he's about to be killed, and then saves, and then she shoots and then saves Mulder, is just pitch perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's another great example of the good duo of the two, and Scully stepping up and saving the day. So nice job, Scully.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, that's the final scene. So let's go. So any thoughts about the scene, the final scene for Bruckman, where we see him?
No, other than we've talked a lot about, you know, is he infallible? Is he fallible? But he is spot on with the prediction about Scully. And you have to wonder exactly what's going through her mind at that moment, because it's got to be this kind of maelstrom of, oh my God, he was right, and what does that mean? And oh my God, he's dead. it's a moment that the writer again allows us to, you know, fill in some blanks there. I think
the one slight cheat is that he states the prophecy is a little bit incorrect, and he states we'll be in bed together, and Scully isn't technically in bed.
True.
Being over holding a hand is different, and if he would have described it that way,
yeah,
you know, the scene wouldn't have made as much sense. But that could be also him stretching into some sort of wish fulfillment or something.
Yes,
like that.
Exactly what I was gonna say. Exactly.
So then Scully inherits Queequeg, who stays for a while. Do you have any thoughts, pro-con, on the pup?
No, just that's fun, that it's an element from this that continued past this episode.
Yeah.
You know, that's really, really fun. You know, it made me wonder if, you know, Darren Morgan had intended that or had even considered that they would keep going with that.
I would hope,
or if it was planned,
they would have to approve it, because she
walked off
at the end. So.
Sure. Well, I guess. I mean, they could have written the dog out the next episode. You know, they could have said that, you know, after, you know, spending a week with the dog, she realized that she hated it and got rid of it or something like that. But no, it's a fun thing. It's life after Clyde Bruckman's final repose.
We'll take as much Clyde Bruckman that we can fit in the rest of the series if we can. So any of these threads that continue on.
It's
one of those threads who continues on, and we see later on in the Chunks from Outer Space, is Stupendous Yappy, which closes the episode as Scully is sitting on the couch watching Laurel and Hardy, and then sees the commercial for the psychic hotline of Stupendous Yappy. And Scully throws the remote and the episode ends. So how do you think of that as a closer? What's your feeling?
I love it because of the display of emotion from her, you know, at the end, that she's still sort of reeling from his death, you know, maybe even feeling a little surprised at how much it impacted her. And also that earlier on, she's sort of kind of laughing at Yappy, you know, or at Mulder's interaction, you know, with the Stupendous Yappy, and then to have her be so angry and furious that she throws throw something at the TV. You know, impotent rage.
I guess I got the rage in the sense of just annoyance is the only emotion I got out of that scene. But okay. I could be totally wrong. I just feel she's just, sick of this. And at the end when he says, I know you will, she throws out there to show the obstinance, like, this is my free will, I'm going to do it. And so the free will idea of her not calling and throwing the phone, like, it looks like she's about to call, and then the phone, she throws it at the TV.
Yeah.
It's cute, but in my opinion, that time would have been so... This is one of those scenes that I would change and make it more... to give us a little bit more time with Bruckman to do his development, because I don't think... Yes, it connects with the free will arc, but it doesn't connect to the emotional arc. And that's one of the things I love about From Outer Space, is that the emotional arc at the end and the way it wraps up the characters and leaves you, combining that with the philosophy of the episode, I think works so well. But here, it instead throws away the emotions and goes straight to a punchline. It's okay. But considering this episode had so much heart, and you had Boyle's performance, and you just had this heavy scene, but there isn't, if you actually look at it, there is not much time spent on Bruckman's death. It's pretty quick. And then they transition to Queequeg and then ride out. And I think that time could have been better used. But hey, maybe I'm a real grab. I'll admit it.
It's funny. It's like I don't see it as humorous as you did, and especially because of how dark it all is. You know, she's sitting in the dark for the most part. Yeah, I don't know. I actually like it. I think it's a good tag.
I like it. I just don't think that episode has space for it.
Okay.
I think that time could have been better used, but that doesn't mean it's bad. And I'm glad it exists. I'm just, because it's one of the most talked about episodes of all time, I gotta, you know, fandom loved. I gotta really dig through the straw to look for some rough bits, and that's it. And it's also sort of a lot of the humor, a lot of the jokes there that we're kind of seeing have already been done. The beats have already been done when Yappy first appeared. There. So the main joke is, is Scully going to call? Because she's picking up the phone, and then she throws it at the TV. Why would she hold it like it looks like she's going to call? This is Scully. She is not going to do that.
Sure.
So that fake out doesn't work, so that whole beat is kind of unnecessary. I think it could have just been Yappy comes on, and you see the tagline. It's 3 seconds, and like, give me a call, hotline, and she just throws the remote or throws the phone, and it ends, and then we get all that other time. Or at least we can get some more time with Scully, actually resonate with the emotions of what happened. But
it also proves that Yappy is wrong, too. I know you will, and then she doesn't.
Well, that could have been done without having to watch the entire Yappy commercial. But again, it's fun. No arguments. Yeah. It's cool. So nitpicking, I've pushed my limits here. I've pushed us over the edge. Jude, thanks again for joining. Can you tell us where we can reach out to you on social media?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe first and foremost, you can visit Amazon, visit my author page on Amazon. Just put in my name and you'll see all my books come up. And then on Facebook, I have what I laughingly call my fan page, which is called The Beard, the Jim Beard fan page. And I'm at writer Jim Beard, all one word, on Twitter.
Perfect. And it sounds like you've got a new book to talk about. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's called Quest for the Space Gods. And if that sounds like a cheesy 70s type of title, then you'd be absolutely correct, because we designed it to sound like a cheesy 70s title. Coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, our Hollywood pitch for the book is Eric Von Daniken meets The X-Files. I love using X-Files in my Hollywood pitches for my books. But if you're familiar at all with the ancient astronauts craze of the 1970s, made very popular by Eric Von Daniken, an author who wrote Chariot of the Gods and multiple follow-ups to that. And then other people kind of picked up on that. But it was a thing that scared the ever-living crap out of me as a kid in the 70s. You know, I look back at it now and I'm not sure exactly why it did, but there was just something so weird and creepy about that whole idea. So in our anthology, we have our main character. His name is Conrad von Hannig, and he is also, coincidentally or not coincidentally, an author. He's a world-renowned author who has a series of books about ancient astronauts, and he's also a very controversial figure. People who don't like him call him Con Man von Hannig. But what he does is he's traveling the world. He's going to go anywhere he possibly can, and a few places that he can't, to dig up more evidence of ancient astronauts for a new book that he wants to write. And he feels this is going to be the one to absolutely prove to the world that he is correct. And there's some weirdness that creeps into his adventures. If you like movies like Altered States that have some moments of true kind of psychedelic weirdness in it, then you might enjoy Quest for the Space Gods.
Yeah, check it out. It's on Amazon. Got Kindle edition. Super great deal. Definitely check it out. And then also for X-Files fans, in case you missed the previous episode with Jim on it, is he's got a short story in the, I think it's IDW. Is that who did it? The X-Secret Agendas?
Yeah. Yeah, IDW did three official X-Files anthologies, and Secret Agendas is the third one. And but still to this day, you know, just sort of gobsmacked that I'm in the book and that I actually got to write these characters officially. All the stories went through Chris Carter's office. They all had to fit in somehow to the official, you know, chronology. We had to specify where they fell in the timeline. And, you know, what a fun thing to write the characters and to try to hear the actors in my head as I wrote. My story is called Desperately Seeking Mothman and takes place in the wilds of Virginia.
It was one of the few books I've had time to read in recent memory of short stories and things that's fiction in particular, and I really enjoyed it. So I definitely recommend the listeners to check it out. It's a lot of fun. And because it is canon and it fits often in between episodes and the way these authors, Jim of course included, really seem to know the material, and so it's the detail for characterization is impressive, and it's a lot of fun. I recommend people check that out too. So, and don't forget also, in addition to that, to remind you, Quest for the Space Gods, check it out, easy to find online. And so Jim, thanks again for joining us. Next week we're going to be talking about, on the XCast, we're going to have a new great crew to chat. We're going to talk about The List. So thanks for listening, and remember, until next time, trust no one.
The XCast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The XCast, and on Facebook if you type in The XCast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The XCast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/TheXCast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/TheXCast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A-Y-E.